It is Wednesday, May 11th, 2016. It's 2:06 in the afternoon. We're coming to you live from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Midtown Atlanta. Political Rewind is on the air. Today we're joined by, as usual, Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read his column in the Dead Tree edition on Thursdays and Sundays. And you can catch up with him and his colleagues anytime at AJC's Political Insider online. I'll tell you what, I would guess, Jim, half the stories we talk about, probably more, on this show come because your Political Insider column that you all do gives me great ideas.
We are a marvelous team. That's all I can say.
Aaron Gulchainen joins us for the first time. We're really glad that you could be here, Aaron. He's been covering, it covers politics in general, but he's been spending a lot of time covering the congressional races with the Georgia GOP, with the Georgia primaries coming up. We're going to talk about the GOP races, especially because there's so much happening. Brian Robinson is stuck in traffic. You know, if anybody should, this guy ought to be lobbying on behalf of the MARTA bill.
Yeah, where's that T-Sploss advocate here when you need him?
Well, he's on his way, and we look forward to talking to him because, among other things, we need to talk to this never-Trump Republican, how he's feeling now. He said many times on this show, no Donald Trump for him. We'll see where he stands now. Aaron, you pointed out before we went on the air that it is incredibly unusual for Brian Robinson, the former communications director for Governor Deal, to not be here to take advantage of an opportunity to fight with three journalists in the room.
We've had some really remarkable knockdowns over the past, 7 years when he worked for Governor Deal. I kind of miss it now that he's out of that role. You know, he's in that role now of advocacy, so he wants to get on your side now.
Yeah,
so
that's
quite
right.
Different.
All right, you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. And in fact, Mark Ross has already send us a tweet. Jenny Ament, producer Jenny Ament, this one is for you. It says, your opening guitar solo sounds like an old 70s adult movie. Why not use the end credits at the start, too? So, Jenny, for whatever it's worth. All right, let's get serious. Jim, we are only a little more than 2 weeks away from primary races here in Georgia. We have a lot of contests going on around the state. But I think for the sake of our show, you're comfortable, we'll focus on the U.S. Senate, the Democratic race for U.S. Senate, and then the Republican congressional races.
It has finally taken just a little bit of a shape. Not much.
Yeah.
Not much. We know, maybe a smidgen more about Jim Barksdale, the hand-picked Democratic Senate candidate than we did 2 weeks ago. We've had its debate. We had last week, we had a GPB debate, which was aired Sunday. You can still find it online, where he kind of introduces himself. He has at least talked to one AJC reporter.
Talked to Greg Bluestein, right?
Right. He has yet to give a major policy speech of any kind before a crowd that I know of.
Well, let's do this, Aaron and Jim. Jim, you know, you and I, of course, were part of the Senate debates when they were taped a week ago. And we got a real opportunity to see Jim Barksdale in action. He has been kind of behind the scenes. We don't know much about him. And we did get a sense of how prepared or possibly not prepared this man, who is the Democrats' choice to take on Johnny Isaacson in the fall. He was asked why he wants to run for this office, and I asked what his message was, and here's what we heard.
Well, I think the key message is that the trickle-down economics that we were sold to and that I bought into for the many years that I voted Republican has not worked. It's left too many people behind. And we've got to get better jobs. We've got to get an improvement in the in the minimum wage. And we've got to start investing in infrastructure. So those are part of it. I'm very much upset about the incarceration. And I'm very worried, frankly. I hear about privatizing Social Security, and from the investment business, I've seen doctors and lawyers come into my office with millions of dollars that they've lost. People with lack of ability. These are very capable people. And to think about putting Social Security at risk like that is you know, upsets me.
All right, so Barksdale is a man who's had enormous success in business. We give him credit for that. But Aaron and Jim, hearing how he presented himself in this debate, is this a candidate who's really ready for prime time?
You know, what I took away from that, the thing that stuck in my head was the fact that he said he supported trickle-down in economics all the years that he voted Republican.
Yeah.
So I still didn't hear an answer as to why he's running or why he's running particularly in this primary. It was quite a pivot there at the end.
The Democrats were in a pickle this spring when Raphael Warnock turned them down, or I think it was a late winter. The pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church, he would have been an ideal candidate. So they've circled the wagons around Barksdale. I think and he has put out his first TV ad, which will get his name ID out there. I think the effort is to get him over the next 2 weeks or whatever, get him out of the primary, and then they would have maybe most of June, July, and August to train him up.
Well, that's the question.
Actual candidate.
Who? I mean, look, we heard him, Jim, over a period of a half hour. I pulled out just one short example of him. He did not answer. He was not focused in a specific way around message. You would think that the Democrats might have prepared him a little better. I get it. They'll wait till after the primary, but still,
it's been a rough start for him. He didn't have a. He had signed up in March 11th, March 10th or so, and it took him almost a month to land a campaign manager. And again, yes, a lot of his answers on that debate were kind of you could classify them as I'll get back to you on that.
All right, but
which is that's a pretty good bumper sticker, I think.
But I think that the best thing he's got going for him is the fact that he's going to show up first on the ballot because he's first in alphabetical order among the Democratic candidates.
Okay,
I
mean, so
who we should mention? Cheryl Copeland and
John Cornyn.
Yeah. Okay. And by the way, if you're interested in watching those, both the Republican and the Democratic U.S. Senate debates, they're on the gpb.org website. So if you missed them on TV, you can see them there. You talk about Jim Barksdale's first commercial. David Perdue had a blue jeans jacket that became the symbol of his campaign to the extent he wanted to know if he could wear it on the floor of the United States Senate for his swearing in.
It has its own Twitter account.
Right, exactly. Jim Barksdale has a cap that Jim Galloway informs us is called a
touring cap,
a
snap cap, if you will. I mean, it's either is acceptable.
All right, so let's picture him. This is a more polished candidate. It's a commercial. Picture him putting on his touring cap as you listen to the audio of this TV spot.
I'm Jim Barksdale. I'm not a politician, and I can prove it. I wear this hat. I'm an investment manager, and I stood against the Wall Street crowd to protect my client's retirement. Now, I'm running for the Senate to stand against the Washington crowd and their bad trade deals, wasteful spending, and mass incarceration. I approve this message because, most of all, I'll stand against the crowd to ensure equal opportunities for all Americans. And I'll keep wearing this hat, too.
Brian Robinson, who will soon be featured in a TV commercial advocating the passage of the new MARTA bill in Atlanta, has made his way to the studio. I'm sorry he had trouble getting here. Brian, what...
sitting in Atlanta traffic, yeah.
You communications has been your business. Barksdale, give us your thoughts on how you prepare a man who, again, has had a tremendously successful business career. How do you prepare him to jump into politics? Perdue did it pretty effortlessly.
Well, the first thing that I say to someone new to politics in Georgia is don't run against Johnny Isaacson. It's sort of like running as Pepsi in Georgia, you know? I mean, you start off without a chance because you've got something that's built in that everybody likes just fine. It's interesting. The reason why the Democrats can't get someone who is even remotely viable is because Johnny's unbeatable. This is not a race. It doesn't matter who wins their primary. Johnny is wildly popular. He's trusted not only by Republicans, but also by Democrats in the state. So, you know, in 2010, I was working with Governor Deal, then Congressman Deal, We were on the ballot with Johnny Idleson at the same time. Running against Isaacson in that election was a respectable Democrat, Michael Thurman, who did not do any campaigning at all. It was a complete shadow campaign. They just had to put somebody's name on the ballot. And this time, they don't even have somebody with a name.
Jim, let's switch over, if we can, for a minute, to talking about Johnny Isaacson. He, of course, did not come to the Republican debate, the Atlanta Press Club Republican debate that you and I were involved with here. What do we say about the fact that Isaacson, who's always been very open to dealing with the media and confronting challenges, not
I don't think
coming.
He's ever missed a debate before.
Right. So what do we say about it?
I think, number one, from a strictly Machiavellian point of view, he didn't have to. He didn't have to put himself on stage with Derek Grayson or Mary Kay Bacalhau. Bacalhau.
I tried that name four different ways.
I know. And quite frankly, I think in explaining his no-show, he took a shot at Derek Grayson, who has used Isaacson's acknowledgement that he has Parkinson's disease as a fundraising tool. He says that, you know, of course, Isaacson's not going to last out a six-year term, and that'll give the governor an appointment, which Isaacson insists is not the case. And I think you have to take him at his word on that one. But Isaacson also went into, or a spokesman for Isaacson, Heath Garrett, also said that Isaacson wouldn't appear with a candidate with a felony criminal record, which
yeah.
Derrickson had back, you know, maybe
20 years ago.
He's had all his civil rights restored. I thought that was a little
overkill.
Given that you've got a governor in Georgia who's trying to create a better situation for felons who get out of prison, I just don't think that was a place to go.
Aaron, Derek Grayson was asked during that debate about his using Isaacson's Parkinson's against him, and he stood up for it. He doubled down. He said, this is important. The voters need to address this.
You know, it's a real touchy subject, but it's interesting that it's coming out this way. I'd wondered for a while whether or not that issue would raise its head in a primary or maybe in the general election. Given what Brian said about Johnny Isaacson, and I agree with him, I somehow doubt that it would become an issue in a general election. I just don't see the Democrats going there causing that kind of pain. But I could be wrong, but it's the whole Grayson issue that Jim was talking about was a little flabbergasting from both sides. I thought that Heath Garrett's response was overkill, is like killing an anthill with a Hellfinder missile, you know. So both sides, it was just a strange moment.
Yeah, so Brian, Republicans aren't particularly worried about this general election.
No, I think we're good. I think we can put this in the W
okay,
column.
Okay, fine. But why?
Yeah.
Why is Johnny Isaacson immune to the outsider fever that is gripping the country? In fact, in a minute, we're going to talk about congressional races, where all you had to do to draw opponents was to vote for the wrong guy for Speaker of the House. So why is Isaacson immune?
That is an excellent point, that because the people who are drawing the primary challenges are actually would be considered by almost anybody, including the Washington Tea Party groups that are the determiners of who is pure in their conservatism. They would say that Louder Milk and Doug Collins are true believers, that they are hard right-wingers, and yet they're getting challenges for not being conservative enough. Johnny, on the other hand, is much more pragmatic, you would say. I mean, he's certainly not a liberal, even though some on the right would use that sort of terminology. He's a pragmatist. He is a deal maker. He is a get things done person, very, very much befitting his real estate agent background. You know, get to the table and make a deal. And I think it has to do with a personality driven outcome. People like Johnny Isaacson. Anywhere you go in the state, you see Johnny there. He's always there for like 5 minutes and then in and out. He's like a specter that droops in and droops out. But he's always there. And that was not the feeling that people had toward Saxby Chambliss, who had a very similar voting record. But Sankey wasn't omnipresent in the state the way that Johnny has been.
Yeah, I mean, look, you've got Isaacson in the middle of the toughest primary season that Republicans have ever seen, I think, in my generation, I think. He is in the middle of cutting a deal on a Veterans Affairs bill. And he's working with Democrats. He's working with Republicans. He's made an enemy out of John McCain on this thing. But otherwise, he's just doing business as usual.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, in terms of that, Jim, he's getting a lot of heat from conservatives about this, but right. Not here in Georgia. He's not about the veterans.
Right. Mitchell. And yet he keeps going along.
I think Brian makes a really good point, Aaron. Johnny, I've covered Johnny Isaacson for literally over 30-some years, and I do think it's true from the time he started off in the legislature, the Georgia legislature, he's a guy that has really made friends. Mm. It seems to be one of the most important things he believes in doing, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he doesn't ever seem to have a bad word for anybody. I remember he showed up for at the memorial service that we had for Dick Pettus. After Dick died a few years ago,
AP reporter who was legendary kind of the AP dean reporter. Of the Georgia legislative press.
And we turn around and there's Johnny to come pay his respects, which was, you know, a very nice thing to do. There's not very many people out there like him in this day and age who you know, people would call friend on both sides of the aisle. He's sort of a throwback a little bit. And once he leaves that office, I don't think we'll have another one like him.
But I'll tell you, he's always been attuned from the for the times. I can remember. And I couldn't tell you the city. We were at a GOP convention. This was in the 90s. I was walking by his side, and for the first time, he asked me to stop calling him a moderate. He was a conservative.
Yeah.
He was a conservative.
Well,
very much the pathway of Paul Coverdale, too.
Right, exactly.
Very
yeah.
much a Buckhead moderate in the state Senate, and then went on to be, you know, a reliable conservative in the U.S. Senate. Johnny's eulogy at Dick Pettus's funeral was absolutely hysterically funny. I wish it was on video because it would be great for a Georgia history archive. Johnny's also the kind of guy who reaches out into areas that many Republicans are never seen. He is always, right. always at right. the MLK Day
always.
Ceremony.
And he stays.
And he stays the entire right. 3 hours or however long it is. Even when the aforementioned Raphael Warnock is making wildly inappropriate political statements from the pulpit, and
but it's also one of those reasons why Pastor Warnock probably didn't enter this Senate race.
Yeah. Well,
I don't know. Warnock had Governor Deal come and deliver a fantastic MLK Day speech on criminal justice, and then turned around and trashed him right afterwards. So I don't have much faith in his judgment.
Well, okay. So let me give a little. People have told us when they listen to the show, they like these little kind of bits of Georgia history. Here's an example to me, Jim. You talk about your encounter. 1990, running against Zell Miller for governor of Georgia. They had a debate at the Temple on Peachtree Street, and Zell went after Johnny's father over some real estate deal. And Johnny started crying. And it became a big deal in that campaign that Zell had brought Johnny Isaacson to tears during this debate. Now, I don't mean he was in hysterics, but there were tears in his eyes, and he defended his dad, which is ironic since no governor in Georgia history, I don't think, has ever cried as much as Zell does at the drop of a hat. But years later, and Johnny did not forgive him easily for that. And yet years later, it's Zell Miller who names him to what, school board chair?
Names him the chairman of the school board chair to control Linda Schrenko, the first Republican state school superintendent.
Yeah. Right.
And then, you know, I mean, when Zell Miller left the Senate, Johnny Isaacson took in most of Zell's staff.
Right.
Yep.
Right. All right. So
Johnny's now chief of staff.
There you go. Enough history. Jake Hallman is tweeting us at PoliticsGPB. Jake says, I wear one of those hats, too, talking about...
He could be the next United States Senator from Georgia.
He says, backwards, though, because I'm 39 and want to pretend I'm still in my 20s. Your crazy uncle, who tweets at T_barf, oh, come on. He said, I've often thought the same thing regarding your opening music. We're going to get a little referendum going, Jenny, on our opening music. Look, it's a good time to take a break. We have a lot of serious business to talk about. Aaron's here to help us walk through the congressional races that many of you out there are going to be voting in a couple of weeks. But it's now 2:26 in the afternoon. Why don't we take a break right now and come right back and talk about Georgia's mostly Republican congressional races.
On the next Fresh Air, how jails have become a warehouse for people too poor to post bail, and why these people often grow even poorer while in jail, in part because many jails charge for room and board and other services. We'll talk with Nancy Fishman, Project Director for the Center on Sentencing and Correction at the Vera Institute of Justice. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on your GPB station.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. With us today, Brian Robinson, political strategist, the former Director of Communications, Deputy Chief of Staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Aaron Gould-Chinen, a political reporter at AJC. And, of course, Jim Galloway, the political writer, kind of oversees that political unit and is the guy in charge. You don't?
Well, no. I mean, let's say I'm the... I'm kind of like the ceremonial president, and we have a prime minister.
I was just more like the godfather.
All right. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to elevate you, Aaron. We have some pretty wild and woolly congressional races going on out there. I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, one of the interesting common themes is that the members of Congress from Georgia who have challengers on the GOP side are all really conservative incumbents, but they're being challenged because they're not quite conservative enough. Is that a fair generalization?
Absolutely. And in particular, in the 9th district where Doug Collins, the incumbent, has a number of challengers, and in the 11th district where Barry Loudermilk does too, it's really been crystallized, and especially in Barry Loudermilk's race, that the reason he has these challengers is that he had the audacity to vote for John Boehner as Speaker of the House as his first main vote as a member of Congress in 2015. And he gained some steam there late in 2015 when he voted for the omnibus spending bill. And he and Doug have just gotten hit over the head with these two particular votes. And it's really remarkable to hear Barry Loudermilk be called, not conservative enough.
Yes.
It's really kind of astounding. Anybody who knows Barry Loudermilk, knew his time in the State House, in the House and in the Senate, knows that he is far from a moderate.
So you set us up beautifully. We had congressional debates here at in our studios, the Atlanta Press Club sponsored, the 9th District, Doug Collins taking on three other opponents. I don't remember.
Four
other opponents, including Paul Brown. Jim, remind us who Paul Brown is.
Paul Brown is the former U.S. congressman from Athens.
10th district.
10th district, who likes hunting and very, very conservative views.
Yeah. So here's what happened at one moment in that debate. You've already referred to it, Aaron. Mm. One of the issues is, did Paul Brown,
right,
when he was representing the 10th district, vote for an omnibus spending bill,
which he accused Doug Collins of doing.
Which
also.
He's
right.
Yes.
So is he guilty? Also, is the question.
Exactly. So Doug Collins chose a moment when he was allowed to ask questions of another candidate to accuse Brown of lying when he said he didn't vote for this omnibus bill.
On 12/17/2007, you voted for an omnibus along with other Republicans and Democrats. So I'm going to give you a chance to come clean right now. If you can be honest on the little things, maybe you can be respected on some of the bigger questions. So did you vote for one or not?
No, I've never voted for an omnibus bill, Doug, and you know better than that. This is just such a far stretch. It's just more of the same of the distortions, the half-truths, and the lies that you've been promoting against me.
Your rebuttal?
I would love to go to the parallel universe that Paul lives in. This is the part that makes you concerned. If you can't trust him to be honest with his vote, he either thinks this. He either thinks he's either lying or incompetent to know what he's voting for, or he thinks the voters of the 9th District are just stupid.
Aaron, tell us more about what's going on there and how this challenge to Doug Collins seems to be unfolding.
It's just like a pox on everybody, isn't it? I mean, so Paul Brown is trying, like we said, trying to hit Doug Collins over the head for voting for this 2015 omnibus spending bill. And Collins is saying, well, you did it too. If I'm guilty, then you're guilty. And then it gets into these crazy semantics of congressional bureaucracy and protocol as to what it was that Paul Brown voted for. Somebody told me later that what he actually voted for was a Senate amendment to the omnibus bill, which maybe wasn't the omnibus bill itself. But it's the fact that Doug used his one opportunity to question Paul Brown about this and not about an ethics charge that we haven't talked about that's hanging over Paul Brown, I think says a lot about how important Doug saw that point. That
because it's about conservative credentials, right?
And it's about cover for himself for also having voted for an omnibus spending bill. But I think that says a lot about how important Doug saw it to try and make this point that others have voted for these things in the past, too.
Of course they have. And look, Doug Collins and Barry Loudermilk voted for those omnibus bills, not because they love big spending and whatever was in them. They did it because Congressman Westmoreland went to the speaker and said, take out that Alabama language that hurts our water rights. And there was a trade.
That was a quid pro quo.
We got a trade. We got our water rights protected, and so we voted for the bill. It is the responsible thing to do, and it is irresponsible to suggest otherwise. Water rights mean more to the future of this state than almost any issue you can think of.
All right. Yeah. Aaron, you brought it up. Brian, as long as you got the microphone there, let me ask you about this. Paul Brown, he's still under a cloud. His chief of staff has been indicted for lying to investigators about a consultant that they used, who they claimed was a voluntary consultant in the campaign, but was getting paid by a congressional paycheck as a member of the staff. Have I got that right, Aaron?
I think you nailed it.
Okay. Yeah. So the question now is the investigation still ongoing? And is Paul Brown in the spotlight? He claims no. In the debate, he was adamant that he knew nothing about it. Boy, he really threw his chief of staff under the bus. But is this going to play into this race in 2 weeks?
I don't see how an indictment doesn't play into a race. I mean,
where
are we?
Sure,
if it's not?
Once he's indicted, but what about just the suspicion of an indictment?
I think the indictment of his chief of staff is enough to make it almost unavoidable as a topic in this. You know, and it's okay. Let's take Paul Brown at his word. He has a choice between two really bad options in his messaging. Either I take full responsibility for what happens in my office because I am the congressman, my name was on the door, and I am the buck stops with me. Or it's, I had no idea what was going on with my office budget. I had no idea what my staff was doing. That's not a good option either, and that was the option that he chose. I will point out, this is not the first time he's had to throw his chief of staff under the bus. His very first chief of staff, a guy named Aloysius Hogan, I love the name, so that's why I said it, he spent so much money on Frank Mail. I think it was like $500,000. And, you know, the budget's only like $1.2 million, that the office was bankrupted. So here's someone whose entire reputation is a fiscal constitutional conservative, and he was the only member of Congress that I ever heard of bankrupting his office budget.
Well, this is a good time, Aaron, to raise this question, whether if this indictment of the chief of staff and the suspicion around maybe Paul Brown being subject to investigation, too. Without regard to that, you wrote a long piece not that long ago in the paper in which you point out that despite the line of challengers who are coming forward in Georgia, despite the anti-Washington fever sweeping the country, so far, the Doug Collins of the world, while they got the challengers, they don't seem to be facing the same problems that other incumbents are. Is that right?
Well, I think what we were writing about was mostly how the money was still flowing to
the
incumbents.
Okay, money. All right.
That incumbency still counts when it comes to campaign cash. Now, I guess you got to preface that by saying that Barry Loudermilk is being out raised in his race, mostly because Daniel Collins put a lot of his own money into the race. But Collins and Loudermilk have both benefited from money from Washington special interests that probably the checks that just came in and probably didn't even have to ask very hard for them if they had to ask at all, related to some of the committees they work on, to the issues that they've pursued. And that's certainly business as usual in Washington. And I was sort of surprised that that hasn't played out more in these campaigns. I haven't really seen a single candidate yet go ask Barry Loudermilk why he was getting money from all those special interests that related to his committee work. You know, it seems like an obvious kind of opening, but it's what's playing out.
All right, so let me redirect the question again back to Doug Collins. Jim, we don't see a lot of polling on congressional races.
No, very hard to poll.
Do we have any sense, any of us, whether Doug Collins is safe in that seat before we go on to talk about other incumbents?
Look, I think so. I think he's safe. I think actually we've talked a lot about Paul Brown's shortcomings. I think the one that we haven't mentioned that may play the biggest one is one of residency. I mean, he is Athens based. He has rented some apartment space up in the 9th district and is trying to make himself known. But he's had some of that territory in the past. But again, I think residency matters a lot. If you ain't from around there, that matters to voters.
Yeah. All right. Aaron, you got a take on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, the question that I would wonder is, what is the reason to vote against your incumbent? And in a race like this, I always wonder, you know, what is a voter's mindset that you were voting against Doug Collins? You would not vote for Doug Collins. And if it's the fact that he voted for John Boehner and back the water bill, the omnibus bill for the water thing, I don't know how any incumbent could survive any race. If those are the two reasons, you're not going to vote for the man. But, you know, like you said, we'll just have to see.
Right. If that's the case, as Aaron says, the only sensible course for any congressman is to vote no on absolutely everything.
Right.
And be completely ineffective for your district.
Yeah, you know, I think that's really an excellent point. I was thinking, as you're talking about the vote for Boehner, it is a symptom of the extreme partisanship, and it's inter-party in some ways partisanship, that you can't even cast a vote, your first vote as a member of Congress, for the guy who will have a huge impact, who you know is going to win.
Yes.
Who's going to have a huge impact on how your legislation moves through the House.
And I love Barry's answer to that question in the debate the other night. He's like, that wasn't my first vote.
Right.
My first vote was behind closed doors with Republican caucus when I voted against John Boehner.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, well, it's not in the congressional record, so your first vote as a member of Congress was for John Boehner, but that's the nuance we have to get to in this world.
All right, go ahead.
And on that, you know, my old boss, Lynn Westmoreland, is retiring this year, so I can use him as an example. He is someone who was definitely a bomb thrower in the State House before going to Congress, being seen as hyper-partisan and playing political games. And he got to Congress kind of with that mindset. He was in this guerrilla warfare, minority party mindset. And over 12 years, he has really grown into a statesman who has served his state very well because he built relationships there. He was cooperative. He got to know the speaker. He got to know the committee chairman. They all liked him, thought he was cool. They loved to hang out with him. And because of that, he was able to help protect Georgia's interest when it came to crunch time. We have got to have that moving forward. Johnny Isaacson plays that role in the Senate certainly very well. Who is going to replace Lynn Westmoreland as the cool guy in the delegation who gets stuff done?
Perfect. Thank you for making my transition for me. The third congressional district race.
The cool guy.
Absolutely.
He is. He's cool.
What a circus. What a circus in the third. This is where Lynn Westmoreland held that seat for 20 years, that long?
No,
12 years.
No, 12 years. Okay, thank you. Decides it's time to step down. Presumably, a lot of people think he's going to run for governor next time around. You got, what, 7 Republicans lined up against him, Aaron?
Yeah, and you talk about wide open. That race is really a lot of fun to watch. Unfortunately, not a whole lot of people have a lot of money down there, so you're not seeing, like, big budget campaign stuff. So it's all sort of on the ground, on social media and in mailers and stuff like that. And we've sort of been focusing mostly on 3 candidates down there, State Senator Mike Crane, Jim Pace, and Drew Ferguson, who seem to be the ones getting traction.
Why are those the 3 that you've chosen to focus on?
Well, we're focusing on them because they seem to be the ones getting traction. Ferguson and Pace have money. Crane has name ID from his time in the state Senate and for his strange comments about drawing down on police officers.
He's shooting
police. You want to hear about that? You want to hear that?
Yeah, yeah.
So, of course, he was asked about this in the debate on the weekend. And here's what Mike Crane said about this comment that he did make. No question he made it. He was talking about no-knock warrants. And he was in a forum, I think, Jim. And he said, anybody tries to come into my house, any police officer tries to come in my house without a warrant, I'll shoot.
No, they have a warrant.
It's a no-knock warrant.
No, no-knock warrant.
But you say without a warrant.
Okay, a no-knock warrant. Sorry, you're right. I'll shoot to kill him. And here's how he explained what he really was saying.
Can they come inside our house and kick down our doors? And my comments specifically talked to the point that I believe I would never advocate harming anyone who didn't threaten my family. And so there was no direct implication by my words that I would ever harm any police. I love the police community. I'm a big supporter of law enforcement. My father's served on two police forces. My uncle's been a chief of police. We need the law enforcement component to do its part. The question is, what in our Constitution allows government to kick down our doors without knocking?
Thank you, government.
Brian?
Oh, I wish you hadn't cut him off.
Yeah, that was too bad. I would have liked to have heard the next sentence.
Full disclosure, I am consulting on the Jim Pace campaign down there.
Yes, thank you.
And the fact is, I for someone who says he's not running as politics as usual, that he's something new, he's not a regular politician, that was such a politician answer. He said, I would use deadly force. I would kill them dead if they came through my door at 3 a.m., with a legal warrant signed by a judge, he said, I would kill a police officer executing his official duties. That is what he said.
How has that played down in the district, either of you AJC reporters?
I think it's mostly gotten people scratching their heads, not sure exactly why he said it or what he meant. But there's a lot. There's a very strong, you know, Second Amendment bent down there, and people against government oversight and or intrusion and stuff like that. I think the underlying message that he was sending that we need some controls on personal property rights and stuff like that probably came across to a lot of people, but then I know there's a lot of people, and my parents live in that district, who were also flabbergasted.
Religious liberty is another issue in that campaign. And Mike Crane, of course, was very much allied with Josh McCoon during much of the legislative battle this year. And Mr. Robinson's candidate, Jim Pace, actually, he has a kind of a little, just kind of an ancillary role there, in that he was one of the big movers and shakers with Dan Cathy establishing Pinewood Studios, which and it was concern for Pinewood Studios that evoked a lot of worry about what the Religious Liberty Bill would do.
To the Hollywood film business, to movie making in
Georgia.
Does the fact that Josh McCoon was apparently punished by the governor, who took money out of the budget for big projects in Columbus, have any sway in the district with voters? I assume the issue is more important than the punishment.
I think it would make them angry at the governor in that district.
Not at their legislators.
Right. Most likely, okay. I would think that.
Although, interestingly, and I do feel like I will be Governor Deal's spokesman for life. But the it's so ironic to me that issue does poll very highly in the 3rd district, and many of those people may have blowback against the governor. But Donald Trump won that district. Donald Trump is still polling the highest in that district amongst, Republican candidates. And he's just fine with transgender bathrooms. He's got a much more liberal position than Governor Deal.
You're asking now for us to add sort of, intellectual parallels to these races that voters who say they support Donald Trump are drilling down deep enough to understand those positions and not just hearing the top line rhetoric to say that, yeah, go Trump, go. I think there's a difference. I mean, I take your point for real, but I'm not convinced of how deep Trump support truly is, if it's superficial or not.
All right, if I may, I have one more sound clip to play for you as we close out this portion of the conversation. Because I think Mike Crane may have, you know, there's this portion of the debate where candidates get to question candidates. I think the top choice for strangest question to another candidate of all was Mike Crane in this moment.
And now it is your opportunity, sir, to ask a question of the opponent of your choice.
Well, I mean, there's several things that come to mind. I was going to ask Sam. I really could ask anybody, but I've got to ask Drew just because he's standing next to me.
Well, let's ask, please.
Do you like loafers or boots?
Mike, I wear what's appropriate at the time.
Very good.
All right, and I take it you rebuttal to that, or you're just good to go?
I'm a boots guy.
Oh, so. You're a boots guy. All right, then. Well, thank you very much.
All right, first of all, I thought the pause
the
and the formulation of, oh, my gosh, what do I say?
I can't say loafer. I can't say loafer.
What, Jim Galloway? I mean, if Crane were the leader in this race by far, fine. You ask kind of a silly question.
I guess that was kind of a very subliminal reference to manliness. I don't know. I mean,
no, I'll tell you what it is. It is chutzpah. And because I've been in these meetings where you determine what you ask the other candidates, and it's always a big campaign team decision because there's so many strategies that come into play. But when you ask a question like that, it is because you think you have a commanding lead and you don't need to draw a contrast with someone. And you may get some benefit from just seeming like a swell, normal guy asking a nice question of a friend. That's what it is. That's it tells you that internally he thinks this is his to lose, that he's going to get a plurality and go into the runoff with a big lead.
That's interesting. What is the internal pace poll show?
Yeah, why don't you give this to us?
Okay, here's my pregnant pause.
Brian, you've taken advantage of our hospitality to talk up your candidate. You've been transparent about it. So the least you can do is tell us what the internal polls are showing. All right, look, we're going to take a break. We have some presidential politics we certainly want to talk about, some of which relate very specifically to Georgia. We'll do that when we come back. It's 2:47 on Wednesday afternoon. You're listening to Political Rewind.
A new debate on campus sexual assault, whether to list a suspension or expulsion on the perpetrator's transcript. Some advocates say it's a safety precaution if the offender should stay or transfer.
How are we protecting students if we're letting perpetrators in?
While others say it brands people for life.
I think at some point Hester Prynne gets to take the scarlet letter off.
Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 until 7 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. I'm here with Jim Galloway and Aaron Gould Shinen of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and our friend Brian Robinson, who is a political consultant working primarily with Republicans. So let's talk about presidential for the next few minutes. Jim, the most newsworthy item, I suppose, today is that Bernie Sanders does it again, wins West Virginia by a pretty significant margin, and gets up and says, I'm going all the way.
And maybe he picks up a delegate, maybe he doesn't. It's the same thing's going to happen in Kentucky. He'll probably win Kentucky too, but not by enough to stop Hillary's gathering up of a few proportional delegates.
She's only
I think, maybe 100 and some odd short now.
Which raises the question, you know, so much of the attention has been focused on Trump talking about the rigged system in the Republican nominating contest. But the superdelegate system, the proportional distribution of delegates in the Democratic race, really appears to many people, including Bernie Sanders and his supporters, to be a fixed system.
It appears that way to Bernie Sanders supporters right now. But I will tell you, I have talked to many and many a Republican who wish to heck that they had superdelegates in their system right now, providing a little ballast for their primary.
Absolutely.
So, Brian, what is Bernie Sanders doing to Hillary Clinton, the presumed nominee, the likely nominee of the party? Is he hurting her? Is he, what is he doing?
He is dragging her very successfully to the left. I mean, this is someone who, as Secretary of State, fought very hard for the president's Pacific trade deal And now all of a sudden it was like, I was kidding. I never was for that. And you're seeing it in her now saying she would never reform entitlements. She's someone who's been more of a centrist, at least considered so within the Democratic Party, as hard as that is to believe. And he has dragged her to the left of the spectrum. What's confounding as an American voter is all these headlines saying Donald Trump is running to the left of Hillary Clinton. I don't know how that's possible when Hillary Clinton has been dragged to the left by Bernie. And another factor that he has brought about is the liberal media that is behind Hillary is having to take the uncomfortable position of talking about how fanciful and unaffordable his plans are when they normally are all for fanciful and unaffordable plans.
All right. Aaron, in reference to what Brian's just saying, Hillary Clinton this week made a big move in terms of her position on the whole issue of single-payer health care. She acknowledged, Jim, that she was willing to consider lowering the age of buying into Medicare to age 50. That is a step toward a single-payer system, which is what Sanders has been campaigning on since the beginning.
Absolutely. And again, this is that move. I mean, you're in a state where we haven't yet come to grips with Obamacare yet. And she is already she's taking us taking the rest of the country the next way, the leg of it.
All right. Speaking of,
I think what Jim's saying on as far as it relates to Georgia, I think that Hillary, particularly if the Democrats take over the Senate, which they could definitely win New Hampshire, Illinois, and Pennsylvania and take over, is very possible. And Republicans really need to focus hard on holding onto the Senate to be a barrier to her agenda. But I think one thing that she's going to be able to do is take an even tougher stand than President Obama has on forcing Medicaid and Obamacare onto states that haven't expanded yet.
All right. Let's turn to the Republicans. Brian, you have not been here since we knew unequivocally that Donald Trump was going to be the Republican nominee.
Yeah. Are you going to play the footage of me
saying that Trump will never be
the nominee?
No, I'm not. But
that would be awesome and cruel at the same time.
No, but look, you're a great example of a guy who has said from the very beginning, a Republican who said from the beginning, no Trump, no time, no way for me. And yet we're watching the Attorney General, Sam Olens. We're watching Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle, the Speaker of the House, David Ralston. Move in the Trump direction.
I was really
surprised by the governor.
Well, I think you all characterized it in the Political Insider as being sort of you softened it a bit. What did that mean before we get to Brian?
Well, basically the deal was saying that let's all stop taking pot shots at the Donald. Give him a little space to explain what he is actually he means for the Republican Party, and let's wait a little bit.
Are you ready to throw in the towel?
I can definitely throw in the towel and say I was wrong. I mean, I own it.
That's fine.
He is.
We were all wrong, yeah. Brian.
He is going to be the nominee. And I have thought about this almost nonstop for 6 months, trying to figure out how this happened when in a party that was being driven so hard by ideological purity and any deviation from orthodoxy would made you a rhino. We have nominated someone who, by any definition, is a rhino and doesn't stick to conservative viewpoints on almost anything other than cultural anger. That's kind of the only part that you see him being part of the traditional Republican mindset.
All right. So the question is, are you going to vote for him?
I've got a lot of soul searching to do on that.
You and Paul Ryan.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, in many ways, I'm a libertarian anyway, you know, and I might vote for
Mary Matlin.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
She joined the party.
We should point out that Jim Carville's spouse, Mary Matlin, who, of course, was a Republican consultant and worked for George H.W. Bush and has gone on fiercely defending Republicans on all of the talk shows this last week, changed her registration in Virginia from Republican to Libertarian in reaction to Donald Trump and to a lot of the crazy talk she thinks is going on.
I think that Donald Trump is a positive indicator in some ways, interestingly, because the party had to change. We were in a demographic death spiral that is well documented. We win based on overwhelming majorities of white voters. That is our only path. White voters are a smaller and smaller part of the electorate. We've got to change it up. And Trump has shown that you can step outside of traditional Republican orthodoxy and win a nomination. And the issues that he has chosen, the positions he has chosen, may not be where the Republicans end up in 4 years and 6 years. But he has shown that there is a willingness to change within the party, to accept different opinions. And we just got to figure out what those new opinions are.
What he's shown is that you can embrace non-orthodoxy and still tick off a whole lot of non-white people.
All right, we all know that tomorrow is this big meeting between the Speaker of the U.S. House, Paul Ryan, and Donald Trump. Ryan has said, "I'm not quite ready to endorse him." Trump has reacted first with outrage, then sort of conciliation. It's hard to tell where he is at any given moment. And two Georgians have actually inserted themselves into this whole thing. Lynn Westmoreland, Aaron, came to with Lynn Westmoreland, who has been in the leadership under Paul Ryan, came out and said, "Paul Ryan, you better get in line."
Yeah, he pretty much said that, you know, it was inappropriate for the speaker to say what he said, and that it wasn't being very helpful. But I thought my favorite, though, was Senator Isaacson's response.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, he was asked on Capitol Hill today, you know, whether or not reporters were descending on Capitol Hill. It was the first time the Senate was back in session to ask everybody if they were going to back Donald Trump. Senator Isaacson said, "I need laryngitis."
We am I correct? We still have not heard from David Perdue on an endorsement. I don't think. Maybe I'm wrong about this, and we can fact check it later.
Nothing overt yet, but he's made enough noises that I don't think he'd have any trouble.
He was fairly supportive earlier.
All right. Let me look ahead very briefly, because we're really short on time. Very quickly, Brian Robinson, is it possible that with Trump won Georgia by a commanding margin in a Republican primary, we all of a sudden there's all this talk about Georgia turning purple. There's more. The demographic is changing. Can the Democrats do enough in Georgia to make the Trump folks spend money and play defense? Can have to play defense here in Georgia, or is this state gone for the Republican, no matter who it is?
You know, in 2012, Georgia was the second closest red state that there was after North Carolina, which had been a blue state 4 years before. So we were already inching into purple territory. You know, Obama got 46% of the vote and never campaigned here once. So it shows they have a pretty high base number in Georgia. I saw polling through at the end of last week that showed Hillary Clinton leading with Georgia independents. And as anybody watches Georgia politics knows, it is those independents who in Georgia are Republican-leaning who are the deciders in Georgia elections. If they don't go with Trump, we could have a real race.
And we're out of time, but the WSB poll this past week shows this a neck-and-neck race as of today.
42-41 Trump over Clinton.
All right, look, we are completely out of time on Political Rewind today. So much to talk about, and glad to have Brian Robinson, Aaron Gould-Chinen, and Jim Galloway here with me. We are back at 3 o'clock on Friday with another Political Rewind. Looking forward to seeing you then. Have a great afternoon.